Hi, Stably.
Hi, Jerry.
How are you doing?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm doing great. Great. Things are just great.
I think everything's great. I think you're falsifying something.
No. I think everything's great.
Prove it. Prove it.
What do you mean?
Go to a picnic.
So Stably, this episode, we are discussing private truths, public lies, the social consequences of preference falsification by Timur Kuran, which was my pick. And Timur Kuran is a economist, I think now at Duke.
Yep, that's right.
And what would you say this book is about?
I think it really is, the title does a pretty good job. So it's interesting. It's not just the economics of preference falsification, which we can get into, like what that actually means. Yeah. It is the psychological and social, and not really the economic, and the psychological and social consequences of preference falsification. So it's on the tin.
It's on the tin.
Yeah, which is rare. And it's interesting that he's an economist and he tries to, I guess, use economic models, but it really is like psychology and history and sociology of preference falsification. Yeah.
And so that begs the question, or it doesn't. I never know what I think at this point, that phrase begs a question now means raises the question. So screw you, people who are sticklers.
Uh-huh.
It raises the question, what is preference falsification? And here's what I think it means. It's basically an act of misrepresenting what your actual belief or want, right, is under perceived social pressures. And perceived is important in that sense.
Yep, that is actually his, I think you just plagiarized the man. That's his
definition. Well, I paraphrased him.
sure. that's his mercifully short and sweet definition.
Yeah. And so what's an example of that?
So he starts off the book, and I guess the book was written in the mid 90s.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Which leads to some interesting.
It sure does.
Interesting examples. But he starts off talking about visiting colleagues in Eastern Europe, like behind the Iron Curtain, I guess at that point, no longer behind the Iron Curtain, and people talking about how people used to live the lie or living the lie. And that was where people in Eastern Europe under communist dictatorship would essentially fake their enthusiasm or at least their acceptance of the ruling system and the ruling party for decades, even though individually many of them, probably most of them, really, kind of hated and loathed the system under which they were living. But externally, they would mouth the slogans and clap and go to the parades and all of that.
But it's not just that, right? It goes beyond that, because number one, why did they do this? They did this because they perceived that there would be social consequences if they did otherwise, right? If they criticized the system. And they actually perceived correctly. Because if you did criticize the system, there were consequences. But it's funny because, you can imagine, as it turned out, nobody was happy. But everybody was not only pretending that they were, but if somebody voiced unhappiness, even those people who were secretly unhappy would descend upon the people who were voicing the unhappiness because of the social pressure. They needed to be seen. Right, to be conforming to the to what they perceive to be sort of the social status quo. Does that make sense?
Yeah, It does to me. I just read the book, Jerry. no, yes, that's right. So it's, you know, like a fuller description of preference falsification is people have their internal, or I guess he calls them private preferences. Mm-hmm. And they, you know, they have a desire to see, you know, public policy or really anything kind of match those private preferences. But they also know that if you're too far off the status quo, or, you know, your fellow citizens
or a group
or a murderous communist dictatorship, you are going to suffer some sort of consequence just because that's the way people are. And so they are going to, you know, figure, well, he has all sorts of mathematical models in the book, but essentially they're going to fake the funk and express public preferences that are different from their private preferences and make those public preferences lean in the direction of what they perceive the rest of the group to believe. So, you know, that's why even though everybody privately, well, not everybody, but most people privately loathe the system under communist, you know, Czechoslovakia or even Russia, Poland, all those countries, their perception of what everyone else believed was people are okay with it. So, you know, it's kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy, really. It's like a circular.
But again, not just okay with it. They could see people descending upon those who express dissent.
Yes. So, you know, one of the ways, because talk is cheap,
right.
One of the ways that you express your contentment with the system is to be not just, you know, silently accepting of it, because again, that's even cheaper than talk. It's to, you know, attack people who step out of line to show what a good little communist you are.
Well, but it's not just, so yeah, but it's not just a talk that silence is cheap. It's that you probably have an idea that if, I mean, it's, you know, that if you stay silent, so somebody dissents in front of you and you stay silent, everybody else you think quite rightly is going to perceive that you are in agreement with the dissenter. Right.
Right.
And so since you don't want to, and so even though you may privately be in agreement with the dissenter, you don't want to be known publicly to be, because you fear social consequences. And so you have no choice, as it were, but to condemn the dissenter, even though you privately agree with him.
Yeah, that's right.
And so he has three case studies that he goes through in excruciating detail.
Oh, it's not that excruciating.
No, I know. we'll get to that throughout the book to sort of illustrate. So he's got chapters that are sort of theoretical, mm-hmm. and then chapters where he applies the theory to three case studies. So one is communism in Eastern Europe, another is the Indian caste system, and another is affirmative action in the United States. But I think something important to highlight is that preference falsification doesn't have to be so deep or about such deep and consequential, you know, subjects as, you know, communism or the caste system, right?
Right.
We just do it all the time. We do it constantly, right? It's when, you know, he gives the example of, you know, you go out to a dinner party, somebody's house, and somebody says, what do you think, you know, we just bought this house. What, you know, gives you a tour. What do you think? And you think it's hideous. You say, oh, it's so nice.
Yes.
Right. Not only do you stay silent, because you wouldn't, right? I mean, because that gives a wrong impression. It reveals your private belief. You say, you lie, and you say, oh, it's so nice. You know, congratulations. It's wonderful. Or when your spouse asks you, you know, does this outfit make me look fat? Et cetera, right? People preference fake all the time. And like one thing that came to mind as I was reading this was, do you remember this when Barack Obama ran for president for the first time in 2008, I guess?
I remember that, yes.
Let me finish the query.
Okay.
During the primaries, when he just first started running, he, you know how politicians all wear flag pins on our lapels? He didn't. And there started to be just news articles. And I guess at that time, even Twitter maybe existed. People would be like, why isn't he wearing a flag pin? What does that mean? Why isn't he wearing a flag pin? Everybody else wears a flag
pin. Why does Barack Hussein Obama not wear a flag pin?
And like reporters would ask him, and he'd say, you know, I just, I love this country. I'm American, but I just, I don't like, I mean, I don't wear a flag pin. Do you wear a flag pin, Stan?
And, I do. I do.
But eventually he just caved, and it was like a matter of like a week or two tops between the time the question started being raised to him. He began wearing a flag pin, and he did throughout his, I mean,
do people still, so again, do people still wear, they it's still here, right?
I think so. Let me look at Biden now that you say it.
Good. I think they do.
Yeah. Oh yeah. No, people definitely political candidates. Yeah.
Right. Isn't that amazing? Cause it was after 9/11, people started wearing it. And correct me if I'm wrong. If after 9/11, people started, you know, people would put flags on their car. This is the American flag, just to be clear, all that stuff. And, you know, as a sign of solidarity, blah, 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 patriotism. And the filthy politicians would start wearing the flag pin, which is understandable, I guess. And then it just never went away. And it's now completely, it seems like completely divorced from why this thing ever started in the first place. This totally like empty performative gesture.
Yeah.
Which
it's just, it's just that now you're making a statement if you don't wear it. Right.
Yeah. It's like in 20 years, people will have to kneel before the national anthem and nobody remembers why. All right.
So I'm looking at a picture of Joe Biden at his press conference on Thursday, and he is indeed wearing a flag pin on his lapel.
God bless, real patriot. Okay. I actually do remember now. Yes.
Yeah.
When all that went down in his tan suit.
This tan.
How can this man be president? Yeah.
So, what else is there to say? How do you want to proceed now that we have laid out what the theory is?
So, you know, the book, like Gaul, is split into three parts, I guess. And so I guess we could tackle those three parts.
Okay.
You know, for those interested in reading the book, you know, it's a fairly easy to follow structure. He introduces the whole concept in the beginning. And he's got a lot of theory, which is, you know, he has some graphs and stuff, which, you know, you're a lawyer, Jerry.
He's got some math. Yeah.
There's a little bit of math.
Yeah.
There's even more math in the appendix if you want to look. I think I saw a sigma. I was like, I can't look at this. Each part is a little bit of theory, some setup, and then he tries to apply the theory to his three case studies, as you called them. So, and those again are, so not, I guess, Eastern Europe under communism, the case system or caste system in India, and kind of the discussion around affirmative action in America circa the mid 90s, which is when the book was written. So, you know, I guess the first part, well, I guess it's technically part two, but, you know, whatever. It's about how preference falsification prevents change.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, he goes into a little bit of the theories about, you know, how this process keeps things, I guess, keeps societies conservative.
Yeah, societies are... there's like a natural conservatism. And again, the flag pin is a perfect example of this.
Yes. And conservatism, not in like the right, not the American context of like
right
conservative
left
politics. Yeah. Yeah. But in terms of
stasis.
Keeping what is right now the way it is. So he tries to, you know, draw a line between like traditionalism, conservatism, and a few other things. So, you know, just because of, you know, he tries to explain this in the previous section, a lot of public opinion has essentially settled on like an equilibrium point,
right?
Or it might be in the process of, and things are always changing, but a lot of things have kind of settled at a point where they're not going to change bar some sort of massive, you know, external shock. So things are pretty conservative for a lot of people. And, you know, it's preference falsification that keeps things the way they are. I don't know if you want to go into the math and the graphs of that, Jerry, or
no, okay, I don't.
Yeah.
And I'll say one thing. So this book, I'm glad I read it. But this is a book that is dying, screaming for a popularizer to come along and write this book in a popular manner, right? It's begging for a Malcolm Gladwell treatment.
Okay.
Because it is an academic book. He is an academic. This is a book by an academic for academics. But what he's saying is so important that I think it deserves, you know, wider attention. And it's getting it, I think, these days. But I still haven't seen a popular treatment of it. And for a lay audience, this book is like, you really have to be committed to read it. It's not difficult to read. And indeed, the chapters where he applies the theory to the case studies are actually very nice. Like he basically tells the stories very well. But in between those theoretical chapters, man, it's, he's just dotting every I and crossing every T, which he should do, right? But it's a lot, and it's kind of painful a little bit. Would you agree?
Yeah, it's one of the case study chapters are a lot of the storytelling, so that's a little easier. You kind of settle back in your Chesterton with your popcorn, your popping corn, and you know, enjoy the story. And the theoretical parts, you kind of have to lean forward and maybe get a pencil out,
right?
And kind of like try to think like, what is he saying, and how does that? You have to keep these things in mind because, you know, it is somewhat technical, but it's not. There's no like advanced calculus or statistics or anything in it. It's just algebra and kind of keeping some concepts in straight in your head. So you probably have to turn off the TV and when you read those parts. But I agree. Yeah, it could certainly use a popularizer just to get it out there. I could also probably use like an update. There's so much more to write about now. It would be.
Yeah, you know, it'd be a lot.
Which is not his fault or something, but it's
okay.
It's
so interesting. Go ahead.
Yeah, it's interesting that he hasn't actually done one yet because, like, maybe he just has so many examples, he can't make up his mind.
Yeah. So, so let's talk about why we have so many more examples. So, okay, so maybe teeing off the idea that there's like an equilibrium that takes hold and it's difficult to move it from there. So part of the issue is that we're talking about questions that have become, how do we talk about this? So you can do preference faking about the decor of your host's home. But we're really talking here, I think, about preference faking in the sort of socio-political fora. Right?
Sure.
Okay. And if you're talking about that, there are a number of things that fall inside of that, right? What is your favorite TV show, or what you think about, or what kind of music you like? Typically you can feel free to talk about that. And no, you're not going to get, you know, any sort of social opprobrium just from saying, oh, I like this kind of music, or I like this kind of cuisine. And you can have debates with people, right? Oh no, you know, fusion jazz is terrible. You know, it really was great when it was, you know, bebop, right? And you can have these fun discussions. But when it comes to abortion or immigration or other things that have been politicized, and increasingly everything's becoming politicized, there's no, you cannot really freely express yourself, right? Without facing some consequence, right? And it could be that within a group, you're going to get pushback, or you're going to get ostracized for expressing a certain view. And so you engage in preference faking. And it just occurs to me that since you wrote this, the number of things that are politicized and thus anything you say about them will sort of signal you as part of one camp or the other has just exploded, right?
Yeah. I mean, you mentioned like what your favorite food and your favorite band. I think those will very easily tell people what tribe you're in now, probably.
Right.
So even those types of things. So it's important to keep in mind, a lot of his examples have to do with politics and political questions. And he does say, you know, there are two broad types of situations. There's just like the private sphere, I guess, and the public sphere. And in the private sphere, it's like what you decide to have for breakfast. You're not going to have any preference falsification there, unless you're posting on Instagram, I guess. But then there's the public sphere. And this is like the realm of politics and society and other people.
Right.
And that's the realm where preference falsification, you know, will exist and will always exist and kind of has to exist for society not to kind of fall apart. And, you know, I think I agree that everything has become kind of like politicized in the sense of it all has to do with like people in Washington, D.C. and politics. But I think in the 90s, if you said your favorite music was gangster rap, I think you might have like some sort of, you might, you know, get some looks at the suburban barbecue. So I think these things were always kind of out there and this stuff was always happening. It's become just completely all encompassing and the stakes are much higher. I think maybe if you said your favorite music was gangster rap at your like white bread suburban barbecue, you might get some looks and maybe somebody would laugh at you. But now if you say your favorite band is, I don't know, pick politically valent band here, you might, you know, be completely ostracized by people and, you know, held to task on Twitter and that sort of thing. So I think it just seems like the stakes of these banal, stupid things have become way, way higher. But I think that people have always been very judgy about everything.
I guess maybe you're right. Yeah. Maybe we'll get to that because his description of the sort of the PC campus wars were very familiar.
Oh yeah, that too.
But here's the thing, right? So there you come to topics where basically the opinions you can have are kind of binary. You're either on one team or the other.
Mm-hmm.
And if you have an opinion that is nuanced, that's in the middle, you're going to get it from both sides, right? Mm-hmm. And so your incentive is to pick one side that you want to caucus with and preference fake for that. And what that means is that, you know, your truth, as Yoshi would say, is sort of removed from the universe of discussion. And so the discussion in the world, the public discussion is just between these two opinions.
Yeah, and this is, you know, like I said, the first section is inhibiting change, and a lot of that has to do with it's like political and everything, but it's kind of social, psychological, like how preference falsification can affect you. Mm-hmm. An individual person, you know, there's a cost to falsifying your preferences. It's like a psychic cost.
Yeah.
But then he's, you know, tracing these things out in how they affect the social world. And like you said, it's not just bad decisions get made and some policy gets picked and it's kind of stupid and nobody really likes it, or fewer people than you would think actually like the policy. It's that this is actually very insidious, because over time, preference falsification can actually, as the title of the section, distort knowledge. That it makes things, like he says, unthinkable.
Right.
And then over time, it's possible that it can actually make things unthought.
Right.
Which I don't know if you want to describe the difference between the two, which was actually interesting.
Yeah, I mean, it kind of speaks for itself.
Fine.
No. He gives the example, I guess, from Islamic history, where, you know, some things were prohibited or taboo. Mm-hmm. So they were unthinkable. You wouldn't do this thing. I forget what the exact example is. Maybe you can remember. But eventually, it became so prevalent that nobody would. It just didn't become an option to even think that way. And that explains, he would say, maybe some of the divergence, shall we say, in development between the Islamic world and the Western world. Does that make sense?
Yep. Yeah. So one of Timur Kuran's other interests is the backwardness of the Islamic world relative to the West for the last few.
Yeah. And he's a Muslim.
Half a millennia. He's Turkish, I think. And the example he used was an Islamic scholar who said, you know, it used to be unthinkable to critically analyze the Quran and other religious writings in Islam. Right. And over time, it just became unthought. Nobody would even consider doing such a thing. It just doesn't come to mind.
Right.
Because unthinkable just means it's you know, kind of gross. You don't really want to do that. Whereas if the thought never comes to your mind at all,
you want to be seen to be doing that.
Right? So, you know, preference falsification, and he has these models about generations and intergenerational, intragenerational effects of preference falsification. And, you know, he kind of contrasts this with this model of cognitive dissonance and a few other models of, you know, how essentially public opinion can change people's private knowledge. Because mm-hmm. he differentiates between private knowledge and not public knowledge. He has a term for it. I highlighted it, but of course it's soft knowledge and hard knowledge, I guess.
Right.
Where the soft knowledge, which is basically, you don't really know what you're talking about, which is basically me on most things. So you just absorb stuff from the ether, what you see on the news and what your friends talk about and all that other stuff. And that can affect your private knowledge over time, because, you know, we are limited creatures. We can't know everything about everything. So, you know, we build our models of the way the world works based on the rest of society. On, yeah.
Yep. Social proof. He talks. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So if the entire society is kind of structured around falsified preferences, it's going to give you a distorted picture of what the world is, what your society is, what people actually want. And it's going to, you know, affect not just your public preferences, but your private preferences over time. And that can become worse and worse as kind of generations surpass each other. And the we said earlier, the unthinkable, the stuff that you don't want to say because it makes you kind of a social pariah, just becomes unthought. It doesn't even rise to the level of consciousness for most people. To the extent that these false preferences are for things that are bad and negative and harmful, which odds are they probably will be, it can just retard, you know, societal progress. It can make, you know, it could just perpetuate a terrible system like communism or the caste system or affirmative action for decades or centuries or I guess millennia if you consider the caste system.
And then he also talks, and maybe we should get past the describing the book and talking into what we think about it, but last thing we should say maybe is it also leads to, so you get these equilibrium, but they're not stable. And you get these surprise results like the collapse of communism kind of basically overnight in Eastern Europe. And basically this happens because everybody has a different threshold for revealing their private preference, right? Or at least making, or a different threshold where their preference faking turns on or off, right? Mm-hmm. And that's based on what they perceive to be the societal response, right? And so, you know, there's the idea of a, what does he call it? It's a cascade, but I think there's a word that modifies cascade. But basically, you know, if you get one person to stand up, and this is actually goes to Joshi's book as well, that where he says basically the one person speaking up can make a difference. You know, it's related. He might even cite Quran. But basically that, you know, if you get one person to stand up and state their true belief, well, that might cause another person to be like, well, if he's talking, then that's enough for me. I'll talk too. And then there's two people talking, and that might lead a third or a fourth person to stand up, right? And then there's a, you know, there's another person who they wouldn't say anything. You know, they would continue to preference fake if only one person had been saying the truth, or two or three. But at five people, they'll talk to, right? And then there's just cascades, and overnight, you get you know, the collapse of communism, you get Donald Trump elected, you get Brexit happening. You know, I've heard Quran talk about Erdogan in Turkey, and how there was this massive preference falsification, sort of people faking that they were liberals when they were truly sort of Islamic, you know,
like Islamists.
Yeah, they were Islamists, right?
Yeah,
and they would keep that on the down low because, you know, for the same reason that a liberal would keep it on the down low in Czechoslovakia. And what we've seen with Erdogan is sort of a surprise, you know, everybody is Islamist kind of situation.
Right. Although now there are probably people who are more secular or liberal who are pretending to be.
Yep.
Yeah. I guess it's informational cascade. Is that the one?
I guess so. Yeah.
Yeah. I think so. Yeah.
So,
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, that's the interesting thing is, as he points out, I guess this is earlier in the book, you know, social scientists have this, have a problem with studying a preference falsification and how it affects, you know, societies, because
you have to know people's private views.
Yeah. But not only that, it's very hard to isolate the effect of it, of like a switch in public preferences, because small effects can have huge consequences. And just the way that social scientists study things, or at least they did back in the 90s, who knows, maybe it has changed with you know, computers, I don't know. You know, people think that large effects need large, you know,
causes.
Yeah. I have a sinus headache, Jerry. Yeah, so like one guy standing up and saying something at a workers' meeting in Budapest, who knows, maybe a year later, that's the little butterfly flapping its wings that caused the downfall of the system. And there's just no way that a social scientist or a historian or anybody is going to be able to figure that out. Now, obviously, it's more than one guy, but you know, those are the kind of small things that can trigger large events. So that's the other thing. That's kind of the danger to like the pressure groups that try to always keep people's public opinions false, is that, you know, it's depending on like the distribution of thresholds and everything, it's very possible that all it takes is like a handful of people to just stand up and say the emperor, you know, has no clothes, and you know, you've lost everything. So that's why, you know, you need such severe punishments, both, you know, not just physical violence, but ostracism and like losing your job and all these things to kind of
swift and severe.
Yeah. To keep people in line, because, you know, if your policy is actually not very popular, you know, you could all unravel very quickly.
Okay, so I picked this book in the hopes that it would help me understand a way out of preference falsification, right? Or at least, you know, how maybe, you know, maybe there was some insight into how Vaclav Havel or whatever was able to kickstart information cascade, right? And how do you expose people to the knowledge that there's majority of people that think like them, but that everybody's keeping it, right? And what I walk away with is that there's no such thing.
Okay. Right?
Yeah. And that this is just, you know, the example of Turkey we were just talking about, where, you know, things are just flipping and maybe they'll flip again in the future. This is just the way we are. There's always going to be this kind of preference faking. And I think really the problem is the politicization of everything is what is making the preference faking problematic, or making it more salient, right? Because we are now preference faking about more things, which means that we are destroying our sense making ability about more things, and have more a bigger surface area to have cognitive dissonance and to have do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah, it's interesting. Yeah, it's kind of a slightly different objection to the quote politicization of everything.
Right.
It's not just it makes you, you know, it just it's a downer and a drag that you can't just enjoy right. stuff, like, which I've always, I'm increasingly finding kind of a silly objection, but whatever. But if you do politicize everything, like capital P, like you're bringing it out of the kind of private or at least the social sphere, and you're bringing it to a point where, I don't know, governors and senators and presidents and Twitter mobs and everything are involved, you're actively making everyone dumber.
yeah.
Like not just now, but forever in into eternity, just people will lose the ability to critically analyze
yeah.
anything and everything. And it's probably not just unidirectional. It's just going to make people just unable to reason, period, right. which is probably bad for everybody. But apparently some people are okay with that. But it also brings to, makes me, you know, realize or, you know, reconsider that any kind of political program, let's say you're, you know, is going to have a pressure group behind it, and mm-hmm. you're not going to accomplish what you want to accomplish with destroying people with facts and logic.
Right.
Unfortunately, because people are the way that they are, they really don't have time for your facts and logic. They got a lot of other stuff going on. So you're probably going to, if you want to succeed, have to apply your own social pressure and create your own, you know, preference falsification in the direction that you want if you're going to accomplish things. Maybe that's right.
Or create your own. Create an environment. Yeah, and I'm not sure that's something you can do consciously. Maybe you can.
Well, I guess
I don't think it's something that think it's something that happens consciously anyway.
Yeah, I guess there are probably lobby groups and think tanks and like we'll just call them pressure groups, like yeah. what he calls them, who do it consciously. Maybe they read the book, or, you know, maybe they've studied marketing or anything else like that, or, you know, public opinion studies, and they realize that, you know, you if you make something embarrassing to say, people will just not say it. And that's how you get the other side to shut up. So, I mean, it's not like people have only started doing this recently. It's pretty old, but I mean, that's kind of unfortunate, right? That you can't just use sweet reason to convince people of whatever you want to convince them of. You're going to have to maybe get a little down and dirty and kind of use the same, well, you can call them dirty tricks, you know, whatever they are to get people to agree with you.
But I think it wouldn't surprise me if that does happen consciously, and maybe it's even significant. But I think it also just happens. So one of the things that he points out is how you can imagine that there are facts that are inconvenient to one side or the other, and expression of those facts marks you a suspect, right?
Oh yeah, totally. Yes,
right. And so that means that certain facts, again, these are facts, right? Something happened in the world, for example, there's photographic evidence of it, right? So like something that's a fact is something that won't get expressed in one side, and it kind of becomes a marker of the other side. So that's the kind of thing that I think probably happens more organically, right? Where, you know, you just, you know, in a meeting or in a context of a particular group, you would never bring up this inconvenient fact. You just wouldn't. And if you did, you're not going to be invited back, right?
Sure.
Mm-hmm. But anyhow, yeah. So it's funny because I'm kind of torn between the idea that there really isn't anything you can do. Well, we should feel a duty to speak our mind, as Joshi would say, because it, you know, sometimes these information cascades do happen, and they happen because somebody stood up.
Well, yeah. And I mean, so there's nothing, it seems like there's nothing you can do to kind of exit this system.
Exit
like there's
the
no,
system.
There's
yeah.
no,
yeah.
there's no solution to people yeah. to preference falsification. It's right. just, it's going to happen. It doesn't even, it's going to happen anytime something is not just purely private. So again, like your boss bought a new house and you have to say it's great, even though it's disgusting. That has nothing to do with politics or anything. It just has to do with,
right.
you know, you were going to suffer some consequences if you say what you really think. And that just happens everywhere. There's more than like one person. So there's, I don't think there's any way out unless we all become Vulcans or get better taste.
Ooh, that's a,
I know that's your preferred. Yeah. Or we all go in the Matrix.
The Vulcans adopted their way of being because they were a very emotional people. They were very warlike.
Uh-huh.
And it was not sustainable. And I forget exactly how this happened, but they decided to excise themselves of emotion.
Yes.
Yeah.
As the Stoics would want us to do, of course. Yeah, sure. But
I don't think the Stoics want that, but yeah, go
no,
ahead.
That's right. That's right. But you know, a Stoic would not, a real Stoic would never
keep his passion in check.
It would never have a hideous house. I mean, that's obvious, right? They're one with the universal God and all that. The only real solution is to fight fire with fire. It maybe you don't engage in the same kind of slimy tactics as your enemy, but you say what you think. And right. that's the only way to kind of keep that threshold alive.
Yeah, but probably what ends up happening if you just say what you think is you just get, like, here's the problem, right? Is that just saying what you think, if it's incredibly nuanced, all that's going to do is, I mean, I'm being cynical here, right? But all it's going to do is going to get you the potentially bad social consequences that you're expecting, but it's not going to get any traction. Right, because it's an incredibly nuanced position.
I feel like there's something that happened recently that you're kind of dancing.
Oh no, yeah. Well, I don't want to get into that.
Yeah. Yes.
I think my recent it's just not worth recounting here. Mm-hmm. But I think my recent experience actually would encourage me to speak my mind more often, because I think it had a positive effect. Actually, that's how I came away from it.
Right.
Yeah.
And I think like that is kind of the point. Like people don't even you, Jerry, the master Stoic rationalist, you probably don't realize that there are more people who agree with you than you imagine.
Right.
And that if you do speak your mind, like obviously, like there are plenty of people who will disagree with you and act like jackasses and call you all sorts of names and banish you to fiat land. But then there will be some people who agree and support what you say. And then maybe that will cause other people, blah, 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 the informational cascade. So, you know, I think it is important for people to stand up and be counted and say what they think, but also it goes to the importance. I know you love the institutions that you need, you know, kind of countervailing institutions on both sides to give support and kind of refuge and resources to people to actually say what they think. Because if you're one lone guy, like imagine you're a professor at some university and you think X and everyone thinks not X. Yeah, you probably will be ostracized and driven out. But, you know, if there are think tanks, if there are foundations, on either side, right? You know, it could be, you know, a very conservative school or you're a very liberal professor or something like that. That's not going to happen, of course. I'm being facetious. It's all on the other side. But, you know, if you have resources and support and institutions, they're willing to kind of, I mean, essentially, you know, you could build it into the model, like the consequences get smaller and smaller of you kind of straying from what the public opinion is.
But the problem is that the logic of politicization and preference falsification is that the equilibrium will be that there's going to be binaries and there are going to be two camps and there's no room for nuance. Right. So even if there is these two camps of competing institutions, maybe you can find refuge in one, you're going to be subject to all kinds of social pressure for all kinds of beliefs, even within that one.
Yes.
If you're not just like some, right. Like again, I mean, so there used to be the case that there were pro-choice Republicans and pro-life Democrats, right? And that was perfectly fine. And it was understood that this was, you know, and there were pro-trade Democrats and Republicans and anti-trade, right? And there were, and now it's increasingly becoming the case where there just isn't. And you've got, on every issue, you've got this sometimes incoherent set of sort of policy preferences that are associated with each side. And that's it. You just have to, and once in a while, they sort of get shaken up, and usually it's shaken up by negative partisanship. Like for example, you know, Democrats, laughed at Mitt Romney when Romney said that Russia was a geopolitical concern. Barack Obama said the 80s call and they want their foreign policy back. Ha, 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 ha. And then Trump gets elected, and then now Democrats are the biggest Russia hawks. Right. It and that's purely out of negative partisanship. My point being that even if you have these refuges and all that, I guess I'm feeling pretty down.
The struggle is real, Jerry. The struggle is real. Yeah. But
let me ask you something that maybe is I'm trying to figure out how to interpret this. If this is a cause for optimism or pessimism. So
what do you think I'm going to say?
His description of the political correctness saga during the 90s, it was kind of like, you read this and it's a basically a contemporaneous account.
Yeah, it was interesting. Mm-hmm.
You could read it about today. It's exactly the same thing. Like nothing has changed.
Yeah, just some of the language. Like nobody says multicultural anymore.
Right. The sort of virtue signifiers are different, but it's exactly the same.
But more so.
Okay, so that's my question. So optimistically, you could say, oh, well, like it's just like this stuff that's happening now is no worse than it's ever been. It's just that maybe we're paying attention to this now again because, you know, Trump's gone and we're not fighting a war in Iraq or Afghanistan anymore and we're not doing this and that, and so we, you know, there's relative peace and prosperity. I guess there's COVID, but and so now we can like really focus internally on this unresolved shit, but it's the same stuff. That's the optimistic. The pessimistic is, oh god, there's a spread everywhere, right? As the Onion recently put it, man tells family that CRT has spread to his kidney.
Yeah, his liver. Yeah, his liver. Yeah.
How do you see the fact that was so resonant to with today, what he described?
Well, I think it. So there's another section of. So as he's describing kind of the PC wars of the 90s, and more to do with like race, like the, not the race wars, but anyway, like the discussion and the fight about affirmative action and race and stuff, you know, he made this point that as in communism, there are these people that are kind of like reformers, or like they're communist reformers. They want to keep the system, but they want to reform it. It's communism with a human face.
Right.
As opposed to a pig face or whatever they used. And that actually won't work because the system is rotten.
Right.
I mean, this is kind of like his editorializing, although I'm gonna agree with him. Like the system itself is rotten. You're not, unless something changes, and we can keep our minds open, right? Maybe they will find the supercomputers will run the world and you can have communism, fine, whatever. You know, the system itself is bad. So this is, you know, I don't want to put words in his mouth, but he kind of makes the same point. Like there are people who oppose kind of the PC insanity of the 90s with you're going too far. This is just crazy stuff. We just need some mild affirmative action and some mild racial preferences. And that's enough. That's fine. But like, no, that's unsustainable. That's, the whole system is rotten. You have to ditch the whole thing because you'll never fix it, right? It's unfixable. And two, you're just kind of undermining, you know, your own critique. And what's going to happen is it's just going to keep spiraling and getting worse and worse until it completely wins or it's overthrown or something like that. I'm not sure if I'm being coherent, but to me, it's like, all of this anti-racism with quote marks, you know, for Miles and CRT and whatever you want to call it, our great racial reckoning, it all stems from just a failure of affirmative action. Like this stuff wasn't working in the 90s, as he points out, or even the 80s. It wasn't working in the 2000s, and it didn't work in the 20-teens, and it's not going to work now. And instead of confronting the system that these people either tacitly or enthusiastically support, and just saying like, this is not the way to help Black people in America and Hispanics and whatever falls under that rubric, like this is not helping, it's actually making it worse. It's like Principal Skinner in The Simpsons, right? It's like, could it be that I'm mistaken? No, it's the children.
Right.
The children are wrong. It's you know, you're gonna double down on like how horrible America is, because look at all the stuff that we've done.
Right.
And look at it, so it must be just like the whole American project is rotten to the core, because why else would these people be failing? Right? Why else can't we get the numbers up? It's because the whole thing is, you know, a lie. It's all based on racism. So we have to fix all of American society.
So two things. So one is, he gives an example, just to buttress what you're saying, he gives an example from India, where after the new constitution and all that, they include preferential discrimination in favor of the untouchables.
Right, the scheduled castes, yeah.
Certain castes, and the founders explicitly said, you know, this is something that we'll have for like a decade, and then we won't need it anymore, and we can repeal it. And lo and behold, today it's still there, and now all kinds of people are, all kinds of castes compete to demonstrate their backwardness, is how he put it.
Sure.
Right. To be able to qualify. And you have all kinds of government jobs that are exclusively the domain of certain castes and all that. So, you know, this is not a uniquely American phenomenon.
No.
So that's one thing.
Actually, Thomas Sowell has a book about this.
It's about the caste?
Well, not that specifically, but it's like affirmative action around the world or something like that. It's actually him analyzing different countries that have essentially tried to help unrepresented minorities or whatever you want to call it through like affirmative action programs, and how it inevitably leads to like civil war and violence and stuff like that. So, if people might want to check that out.
So then again, I'll ask the question again. Is it that we are just stuck in the same place where we're in the 90s? It's just that we took a break from focusing on it. because we had other intervening, you know, we had 9/11, the financial crisis, wars, you know, et cetera. We took a break from focusing on that. And now that we, you know, there's relative peace and prosperity and no external threats, we can kind of go back to fighting each other, that we're back onto it, right? So is it worse? Is it the same? Does it matter?
You know, it's hard to say. I mean, I wasn't there in the 90s, like at universities. I mean, it's like in the way he describes it, it seems very similar. It's probably just more encompassing. It's just everywhere.
It's just everywhere.
It's way more aggressive.
But again, is it everywhere, or is it just that we now have social media? And so we can see it everywhere.
Well, you see what I'm saying? When you look at the local Montessori schools, do they have a diversity, equity, and inclusion statement?
Right.
For your four-year-olds?
Right.
Probably.
Yeah.
You know, they can't stop adding colors to the rainbow flag.
Right.
Like, it was fine. It was fine the way it was. You know, like, it is like an arms race to outwoke each other. Right. And it seems worse, but, you know, then again, like, I don't know. It's hard to say. It always seems worse when you're living through something.
Right.
I mean, it's basically the equivalent of World War II, if you ask me. So it seems bad. I don't know if it's worse or not worse. I just don't see any, like, actual stopping point, because people won't address the actual, won't address the real problem as I see it.
People will not face reality. One might say.
Sure, they won't face reality. And, you know, unfortunately, as this stuff happens, you start getting interest groups who are happy to perpetuate these things because it gives them money and jobs and recognition and a leg up. So on the other hand, this could just be Czechoslovakia 1988, and all it takes is a few people to just stand up and say, like, this is garbage. Like, you're lying, and I don't believe you. And more people, just because most people are kind of cowardly and don't want to put their neck out, they're not going to say anything until some threshold of people, you know, put their neck out. So maybe that's what needs to happen. And I, you know, obviously there's more and more pushback. I'm not sure if it's the right form of pushback, but it is coming. So,
yeah,
you know, maybe this is just what happens when, you know, the very online starts to affect real people, when it, you know, leaves campus,
right.
And Twitter, and starts, like, hitting people in the face.
Yeah, that's the thing. It seems to me like they are definitely overplaying their hands and inviting a backlash, that I think is is certainly imminent, in a way. But then I read this and I'm like, oh, maybe not.
Like, it didn't go away. I don't know why it kind of, these things kind of cooled in the 2000s and kind of early 20 teens, but this stuff, like, started coming back well before Donald Trump. I'm not even sure he was running for president when, like, the Yale thing happened.
Right.
You know, it could be that Donald Trump is president because of these things.
Yeah.
Not his president. Well, he is president. don't let them fool you. It could be that, you know, he was elected president in because people got fed up or wanted to stick it to the libs by voting for that man.
Maybe we've already, is the backlash.
This is the backlash. And like Karan says, like, these big things, they might have very small causes. Like, we're talking, like, oh, what's the great political socioeconomic thing that created this? And it could just be something very small. It could be a lecture somewhere. It could be
even a little book review podcast somewhere.
We could only hope. Right. So I don't know. In short, it seems a little grim, but it also seems like the people fighting back are kind of the worst.
Yes, that's the other thing. Yes. Yeah, it is not the most nuanced people standing up. Although, look, I think you're starting to see, you know, since this has been coming to schools and it's affecting people's children, you know, you're starting to see parents stand up. But even then, it's
right. I mean, there are plenty of articulate intelligent, like non-horrible people fighting back against the wokesters and everything. And they have been for a while. It's just that usually when you get like politics involved, it's the zeros and the 100s. It's the worst on both sides.
Yeah, who gets the clicks?
Yeah, fighting it out. So we shall see.
All right. Anything else you want to say about this book has the worst title because I can never remember which goes. It's Private Truths, Public Lies.
Pride and Prejudice.
Yeah.
It's good. Read it.
So you recommend it?
I recommend it. Yeah. Just realize that you're going into it. It's not like it's not the easiest read, but it's not the hardest. What was the word? It needs
a popularizer.
A popularizer, not a publicist, but a popularizer. Maybe he could rewrite it. I think it would be great to kind of update things. I'm sure there's been a lot more research, a lot more stories to tell.
Yeah.
Timur Kuran, if you're listening, invite me up. I'm just down the street. We'll talk about it. I think it's due for maybe a second edition.
Yeah.
That would be interesting. And hopefully that would cause someone to become the popularizer.
Right. Yeah. I recommend it, but you have to understand what you're getting into. This is an academic book. I would recommend for anybody who is kind of curious about delving into these ideas, but doesn't maybe want to commit to the book just yet. Glenn Lowry has a essay also from the, I think, late 90s called Self-Censorship in Public Discourse, A Theory of Political Correctness and Related Phenomena, which cites the Quran book and basically it addresses a lot of the same material. That is, it's like 30 pages short and it's, straightforward.
Or you could listen to his 4-hour podcast with Eric Weinstein.
Who, Quran?
Yes.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah.
That too.
Yes.
Yeah. All right. So next time it's your pick, Stably. What are we reading?
So we are reading Great Founder Theory by, and I'm going to mispronounce the name, Samo Buria.
Yeah.
Sounds right. Yeah. So he's a very interesting young Slavic man. I'm going to find his little bio, founder of Bismarck Analysis. It's kind of like a private, what would you call it? Like a private...
Just a consultancy.
Consulting firm, yeah, for but kind
the,
of like...
I think it's kind of a lot like the great Zeihan. Whereas Zeihan, I think, does geopolitical. This guy just does more political consulting or political advisory. So like, how is the changing landscape of politics going to affect your business? Kind of thing.
Yeah, exactly. So really interesting guy. He's been on a lot of podcasts recently. He's really interested in like history and sociology and politics and, could be a crank, could be not. He wrote a book and decided to just kind of put it out there for people to read the manuscript and make fun of it and suggest edits and improvements and that sort of thing. So that's great. It's available online, Great Founder Theory. So, that's kind of, it's about founders.
So that's interesting. One more comment I actually had a note about for the Quran book.
Uh-huh.
Was it a thought it provoked in me is that that the people at the top of an organization, if they are not the founders, they are basically survivors, right? So they have basically preference faked their way to the top, right? So like what recently happened at Apple with like Antonio Garcia Martinez would only happen with Tim Cook at the head of Apple.
Mm-hmm.
With Steve Jobs at the head of Apple, Steve Jobs would have fired all the people who signed the petition.
He would have eaten them.
He would have eaten them, right?
Yeah.
Or at least I'd like to think that's. I don't think it would even occur to people to fucking petition Steve Jobs, right?
Yeah, it probably just never would have happened.
It would go from unthinkable to unthought. Right?
Yes.
Yeah. So it's funny because I think we hear a lot of Silicon Valley types talk about founders and we make fun of them, right? Because anybody can be a founder if you think about it. You just found, you know, you just like take $50 and incorporate something in Delaware, you're a founder. Congratulations.
Well, yeah, my dad started his own like dental technician company. He's a founder.
He's a founder. But there's something to it, actually, that this book made me realize, which is there's a difference between a founder. So, I mean, a founder of a going concern that is who's running a going concern and somebody who's running a going concern that was not the founder. It's just completely different animals. So maybe that's what this book will be about. I have no idea.
We're about to find out.
All right. Stably, a pleasure as always.
Right back at you.
All right. See you.
Okay, bye.